Hello, you're listening to Science Digest. I'm Lynn Spears, a volunteer reading for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today I'm reading articles from Nautilus Magazine, the 2026 edition, issue 65. Some of the articles I'll be reading are Tasting for Tomorrow and This Meal Might Bring You to Tears. Our first article today is called Tasting Tomorrow. Can We Eat Local on a Warming Planet? By Jonathan Keats. In the Mexican city of Puebla, every family has a recipe for tinga. There might be disagreements about whether the stew should be made with chicken or beef, and some might quibble about the chipotle peppers, which can be smoked or sweet, but every poblano knows to serve tinga with corn tortillas. Last November, I was offered something different. The tortillas were made with teff flour from Ethiopia. At the same meal, I also ate tamales, another Mexican staple, conventionally filled with corn masa. The dough I tasted had a similar texture, but not quite the same flavor because it was made with Ethiopian chickpeas. I admit that I was not an innocent bystander. In fact, I was an instigator of this culinary experiment, one of dozens I've co-organized worldwide. Tasting Tomorrow, as we've dubbed it, is an attempt to figure out how heritage cuisine might withstand the impact of climate change, and how peoples from Mexico to Spain to India might cope with the stresses and strains on traditions that literally and figuratively sustain them. Nearly a decade ago, I started exploring the kinds of infrastructure that hold communities together. At the same time, concern about extreme weather was mostly directed toward bridges and tunnels. Although these will certainly be imperiled in the future, and some have already crumbled, my focus has been on cultural infrastructure, the customs and rituals that help people live meaningful lives and relate to each other. I've come to believe that these qualities will ultimately matter more than feats of engineering because they're the foundations of cooperation, and none of these customs are more universal or more primal than food. Heritage cuisines are highly vulnerable to global warming because their core ingredients are adapted to historical weather conditions. Maize is indigenous to Mexico. The corn in tamales and tortillas was first consumed because it was readily available. As the climate changes, those staples are unlikely to grow where they have in the past, at least without technological interventions that could redouble troubles, such as diverting rivers for irrigation. Shipping customary crops from afar exacts another environmental cost equally steep, since transportation requires energy, typically in the form of fossil fuels. In other words, the global challenges of food and water insecurity are especially profound in terms of familiar foods and the sense of security they provide. At the University of Maryland and North Carolina State University, my colleagues Matt Fitzpatrick and Rob Dunn have developed a method known as climate analog modeling to forecast changes to natural ecosystems. Their models use the United Nations IPCC data to predict future climates based on geography. Based on predictions of the weather in many locations 70 years in the future, they've identified locations today with equivalent weather conditions. The information is useful for conservation efforts and future foodways. To see the future of San Francisco, look to Tangiers, Morocco. Saudi Arabia provides a good approximation of the Iberian Peninsula of Spain in 7 decades. Nagaland in the far northeast of India on the border of Myanmar is anticipated to have the climate of the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province of Pakistan close to the border of Afghanistan, and Ethiopia is a reasonable proxy for Puebla. Seasonal temperatures and rainfall are both salient factors. San Francisco is expected to be more than 6 degrees Fahrenheit warmer and 13% wetter in the winter. Puebla is expected to be nearly 8 degrees Fahrenheit warmer and 4% drier in the summer. These predictions necessarily make myriad assumptions about political decisions. Indeed, the forecast might motivate policy changes if presented in ways that people can experience in the present, notably in the food they eat. Tasting Tomorrow is motivated by mitigation as much as adaptation. Substituting ingredients from climate analog locations, we're trying to figure out how to maintain culinary traditions in the future. But we also want people to let people taste the differences for themselves, something that cannot be done with raw data. In Puebla last November, nearly 30 locals gathered at the Museo Urbano Interactivo to argue about what makes a dish like tinga uniquely poblano. Is it the flavor, the texture, the way it's served at a family gathering? Based on these criteria, they cooked new versions of tinga, incorporating ingredients we imported from Ethiopia, seeking to retain the qualities they most valued. They also made Ethiopian versions of tamales, cemitas, and mole de pollo, all of which were served at a community gathering. For a city as traditional as Puebla, the response was astonishingly positive. "We didn't get run out of town." The manager of a local restaurant quietly took note of the recipes. Collaborating with local people is the crux of Tasting Tomorrow. Their tastes and traditions guide every decision. In Nagaland, for instance, indigenous cooks tried replacing wild rice with millet from Pakistan. Responses were mixed. "Perfectly soothing," said one. "I didn't enjoy it," retorted another. We've also worked with award-winning restaurants. During the Dubai Future Forum a couple of years ago, we partnered with a chef from the Iberian Peninsula on a version of Menchenko cheese, substituting the usual sheep's milk with camel's milk from the Gulf. At a ticketed dinner, elite guests digested a future that is highly probable unless people in their position take action. Unfortunately for the future of the planet, the cheese was delicious. The simultaneous need for mitigation and adaptation presents a paradox, since success of the latter diminishes the urgency of the former. Although Tasting Tomorrow does not resolve this paradoxical situation, I have witnessed the impact of putting unfamiliar ingredients in people's hands and encouraging them to try foods that are just noticeably different. The effect is to activate their sense of agency. A small choice, such as the decision to stuff a tamale with chickpeas instead of maize, initiates a cascade of larger considerations. Participants recognize that they have options and experience the power of creativity to make the most of a bad situation. Recently in San Francisco, the city I call home, I've begun to take the opposite approach, seeking to meet the paradox from the other end. I've started to distribute packets containing seeds to grow tangerine plants, a staple crop in Tangiers, one of San Francisco's climate analogs. Each packet is printed with instructions directing the recipient to retain the seeds as a form of insurance for future generations in case climate change continues unabated. The envelope in which they're sealed is presented as a challenge to everyone living in the present. What actions are people willing to take to alter the planetary climate trajectory, ensuring that the packet will never need to be opened? I still have a hankering for those teft tamales, but the seed packets feed a different part of the imagination. As important as it may be to collectively cook up palatable futures, it is also essential that we communally hunger for a tomorrow that tastes like today. Our next article is called, "This Meal Might Bring You to Tears," experimental psychologist Charles Spence on how our senses shape how we eat, by Kristen French. Most of us would say we taste our food with our tongues. Charles Spence has spent decades showing that we eat with our eyes, our ears, our fingertips, and even our emotions. An experimental psychologist at Oxford University, Spence has learned that when we sit down for a meal, all of our senses come to the table, and some of them have unexpected effects. Heavier cutlery, for example, makes a meal more pleasurable, he has found, and flavors in space are often duller. Foods that sound better taste better, too. In his infamous sonic chip experiments, he found that the louder the crunch of your Pringles potato chip, the fresher it tastes. Work that won him a 2008 Ig Nobel Prize, which celebrates real science with a side of humor. Spence has also explored the ways our senses shape our palates in numerous books. In Gastrophysics, The New Science of Eating, he presents a tour of all the strange, invisible forces that color eating and explains why your brain is the real chef. In The Perfect Meal, The Multisensory Science of Food and Dining, he and his colleague Bettina Piqueras-Fitzman map the entire multisensory ecosystem of dining. And in Sense Hacking, How to Use the Power of Your Senses for Happier, Healthy Eating, he recommends ways to employ colors, sounds, and scents to reduce stress and better your quality of life. Spence's newest line of research connects biophilia to flavor, how glimpses of green, a whiff of cedar, or the call of a seagull can change what we choose to eat and how we think it tastes. Many high-end restaurants have begun experimenting with building the eating experience around nature-related sensory elements, such as sounds and smells and tactile pieces, sometimes to dramatic effect. We caught up with Spence shortly after his trip to a cloud forest outside of Bogota, Colombia, where he'd been eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner outdoors, so long as it wasn't raining. We talked about why a single word on the menu can make a dish sell out, why certain culinary experiences leave diners in tears, and why rosé tastes better on a beach in Provence than back home in your kitchen on a Monday night, and also why the simplest dishes are still the most delicious. In your work, you often talk about the provincial rosé paradox. Can you explain what it tells us? We all feel like we can really just taste our food and drink. None of us feel in the moment that the atmosphere, the environment, the nature does something to us or to our judgments. That's why I always start with the provincial rosé paradox. Northern Europeans go on their summer holidays to the Mediterranean quite often. It's warm and sunny on the beach, and the food and the wine taste wonderful. And everyone brings some back home to share with friends and family on a cold winter's night, and it just doesn't taste the same. You say, well, maybe it got shook up in the airplane or got cold, and that's what spoiled it. But I think the wine's exactly the same. Your mood and environment are different. Everyone holds within them the belief that I can really taste the gin and tonic in my glass or the Doritos on my plate, but the research shows it's influenced by the softness of the chair I'm sitting on or the dimness of the light. And why is it that the rosé tastes so good on vacation? Is it the sound of the seagulls? Is it the warm sun? Is it the relaxation in your mood? Well, that's all subject for experimentation, investigation. I think all those things matter. You recently began looking at the relationship between food and biophilia, the idea that humans are innately attracted to nature and natural forms. What inspired you? When the biophilia research first came out decades ago, it was kind of flimsy. All these studies aim to show that going out into nature is beneficial regardless of the sense with which you experience it. Sight, sound, smell, touch, taste. But by the time I revisited the literature in 2021 for my sense-hacking book, the studies had gotten so much more rigorous, and it really seemed to show that exposure to nature has amazing effects. Around the same time, a number of chefs began doing immersive dining through projections and sound effects and smells. These chefs could have created any kind of immersive environment, Mars or being underwater, but all of them seemed to choose to recreate nature. The sounds of the sea, the smell of the salty sea air, forest scenes. Chef Jose Youssef of Kitchen Theory in London has a mushroom dish that involves projecting greens onto the table, the sounds of the forest, the smell of the earth after it rains, and a plate made of a slice of a tree trunk. So it got me thinking, maybe these things are connected. Maybe intuitively the chefs had figured out that by recreating nature, it both emphasizes the natural source of the ingredients, but it also has an effect that helps us to improve the diner's well-being. Now we have research showing that the blues or greens of water, the color or scent of flowers, even birdsong, can make food taste better and make it easier to tell flavors apart. We've even got experiments suggesting that nature soundscapes and water soundscapes will nudge people to make more sustainable food choices and leave less food waste. Presence of warm, ambient odors like cedarwood seem to make people eat fewer calories, and mixed herb scents make people choose more wholesome things to eat. These findings could have implication for vending machines, frontline sales, and even self-help. What are ways architects and designers could use this to support healthy eating, bringing nature into the built environment? Interestingly to me, you might think that it has to be real nature, real birds and real plants, not staring at the screensaver that's got a nature scene or at a plastic plant, but all the research I can find says they're just as good. Since digital nature is as efficacious as real nature, we can start to caricature digital natural environments or plastic natural environments to have more of the stuff that's good for us. And this works for any of the senses. Through hearing, anything that includes nature sounds or water sounds, but the more naturalistic the bird song, the better. And the more bird varieties, the better. Through touch, a rough surface, or a texture, textured surface rather than a smooth one. You mentioned the nature-inspired sensory elements many chefs are using in their restaurants. For some people, it seems these sensory elements have surprising emotional effects. There is one immersive dish called Sound of the Sea, served at Chef Heston Blumenthal's The Fat Duck Restaurant in Bray in the United Kingdom, that features the sounds of the sea and birds play through a conch shell on the table. The visual presentation of the dish is designed to look like the seashore. The dish consistently makes people cry, and I wondered why would an experience like that make someone tearful? The seaside dish is not the only one that makes people cry. I came across a chef in Milan, formerly a filmmaker, named Federico Rodigni. He's got a restaurant called Sensorium that offers a multi-sensory dining experience where the meal engages all five senses, sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell, to tell a cohesive narrative story. You're listening to Science Digest. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. He cycles the theme of his menu every year or so, and a recent one is Ayahuasca, albeit without the hallucinogens, which includes a course of rice pudding that makes 60% of his diners cry or feel like crying. When I met him, he said to me, "I didn't plan my dish, my menu this way. None of my previous menus have had this effect. I don't really know what's going on, but this one dish, people are crying, and as a chef, I have no idea what's going on." And so we have been doing experiments for the past year in his restaurant with 100 diners who have the full multi-sensory experience. And then you get a questionnaire. Did you cry tonight? Which course did you cry for? How much did you like that dish? And then we tested 100 people without the multi-sensory bits and pieces and asked, how often did you cry? And then 100 delivery drivers are given a bowl of rice pudding. Of course, the delivery drivers don't feel like crying. No one will cry when they walk into a restaurant for the first dish. So you need to settle, need to relax a bit. It's more likely later in the meal that you might cry than at the beginning. So this rice pudding dish is number 6 out of 10 courses. And the emotional trajectory of the story being told through the meal is a kind of Cinderella story. And at that rice pudding stage of the meal, the emotional trajectory of the story has gone from things really bottoming out to the final ascent. You've got nostalgia, and it comes with low-frequency vibrations, these very low-frequency sounds that you can't hear, but when they're happening, you're more aware of your body. Altogether, it creates an extraordinary response. We've got the data and the graphs and the results, but we haven't published it yet. We used to use the science of the senses to make things taste better, sweeter without more sugar or saltier, but all within the known taste universe. Now we can deliver extraordinary things you've never tasted before. Dishes that make you cry, feel awe, or get a shiver. So what's going on when people cry over their food? It could be an aesthetic aha moment, the kind you might feel in Rothko's chapel, that release of tension that you get in art and that maybe you get in this dish where everything falls into place. Are these multisensory experiences really bringing nature into the dining room, or is this more of a high-tech hack? Are there risks to having these digital technologies integrated into the way that we eat in terms of alienating us from our food and from each other at meals? Yes, definitely. I think from the research, the simple biggest factor determining how much food one consumes seems to be whether the TV was on. The more distressing the program, the more entertaining the program, the more we consume. Researchers have subsequently shown very similar effects with digital devices. I've never had a digital phone and hopefully never will have one, but to see that sort of alienation and separation of people in the restaurant and the young couples, and they're both on their phone and neither of them are there with the food. So the multisensory technologies could either have a similar effect or it could enhance the experience, so it could go both ways. For a while, there was a theme restaurant craze, but all the technology was there to distract you with lights and sound, like the simulated tropical thunderstorm at the Tonga Room and Hurricane Bar in the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco. In the 1970s, this kind of entertainment only meant one thing. The food is crap. Now chefs are really trying to enhance the food with these sensory atmospheres created through technology. But it must always be a danger that the technology will just distract. You've worked with philosophers over the years as well. How do you think the distinctly multisensory experience of food relates to our own sense of reality? When I was first an undergraduate here, I started doing philosophy and psychology, and then I dropped philosophy because it was too hard. But it's always been something of an interest. Taste consciousness research doesn't really exist, but it should. And if my consciousness is on the TV show or Instagram or something, then am I not conscious of these other things like taste? How do we make people more mindful of food? Because the more sensations you get from a food experience, the sooner you are sated, and then the less you're going to consume. Modern technology distracts our consciousness to something else, so we're not aware of the sensations. I've been lucky to work with philosophers in the past to try and get straight the distinction between tasting, smelling, and the experience of flavor. Currently, I'm working with other philosophers on the question of whether chimicesis, the burn of chili, and the pungency of ginger and pepper should really be treated as a separate sense from taste. For me, flavor is so intriguing both because it has been so little studied from a philosophical perspective and because many of the questions that it throws up are so challenging to address conceptually. What else are we learning about how our other senses impact how we experience taste? We have found that sweet tastes are high-pitched and bitter tastes are low-pitched. If we play low-pitched music, it brings out the bitterness in chocolate. If we play high-pitched tinkling sounds, such as wind chimes, it brings out the sweetness. There's also a kind of overlap in how we talk about emotions and foods that spills over into our experience of it. We'll say someone has a sweet smile or a sweet personality, and research shows that if you look at somebody with a smiling face, things taste sweeter. If you look at somebody crying, things tend to taste more bitter. What is the most delicious dish you've eaten recently? A study just came out that suggests diners always want something new. Fusion food or global cuisine or molecular gastronomy. I go to a lot of these Michelin star restaurants in a number of different countries, from Latvia to Poland, and I can see there's a lot of technique there. They're technically well done. Interesting maybe, but delicious? We've lost that, I think. We lose it by focusing on everything else. My brother and I always come back to this dish, which is from the River Cafe in London, a famous Italian restaurant. It's just 10 kilos of pork shoulder or pork leg, roasted for 24 hours in the oven with lots of fennel seeds, lots of crushed garlic, a bit of chili, olive oil, and that's it. And that is one of the most delicious things around. I made it last Christmas because my father got too old to remember how he used to make pork, and people up the street were saying, "What's that smell?" After all these hours, the flavors just meld and do something magical. Something fabulous happens. There's nothing fancy about it. When was the last time you had a meal in nature? At my brother's restaurant on a Sunday on the outskirts of Oxford, he's got an organic kitchen garden restaurant called the Wharton Kitchen Garden. We ate there in the greenhouse, but had to walk through the garden to get to our table. Do you ever use your brother's restaurant as kind of a lab? Yes, in some cases for ideas, not that he necessarily listens to my advice. He has one dish called the crispy duck salad, which he introduced for Chinese New Year, but then it just stayed because it was so successful and everybody wants it and loves it. But why? Is it the sensory word crispy? He's got no idea. It's just the best-selling thing he's ever put on the menu and can't take it off. So that's an experiment we'll probably do. An online survey with two versions of the menu. One with crispy duck salad and another with Chinese-style duck salad or something like that. We talk about the impact of the smell of the peppers in the restaurant has on whether the diners will order it. And some days he sells out of lobsters and crabs, and other days no one orders them. So is that the weather or is that the smell in the air?
So there's always ideas for experiments. You've been listening to Science Digest with readings from Nautilus Magazine. I'm Lynn Spears, a volunteer reader on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening to this week's episode, and I hope you come back next week. And as always, have a great day.